I'm Laura Layfield, and you're listening to Your Next Podcast. This is the podcast that brings you a different series every single week, helping you to find your new favourite show. Now, look, I do promise that sometime soon I'm going to get over my obsession with history podcasts, but guess what? Today is not that day. This one is called Intoxicating History, and you might have guessed from the name, it has something of a twist on the format. So this is a show all about the history of the world, but it's told through the story of alcohol. So the history of drinks really does reveal a surprising amount about the history of the world, from the rise and fall of empires to the way that drinks shape the lives of some of history's most significant names. So we are starting with the story of port, which I put in my gravy. Little tip for you there, makes it taste really nice. Author Henry Jeffries and journalist Tom Parker Bowles are tracing the story of alcohol through the ages. So enjoy.
Intoxicating History is brought to you in association with Taylor's Port, embodying the essence of port since 1692. Step through the door of history's greatest tavern, where every bottle tells a story.
And what stories they are. I'm Tom Parker Bowles.
And I'm Henry Jeffries. Welcome to Intoxicating History, where we're serving up the past one drink at a time.
From royal cellars to revolutionary alehouses, we're explaining how what filled the glass changed the course of history.
In each episode, we'll uncork tales of power and passion, of empires and intrigue, all through the drinks that shaped them.
And naturally, we'll be sampling as we go.
A properly matured port is rightly considered unequalled as a test of the pretensions of a country family to proper pride, patient manly endurance, Christian self-denial, and true British tenacity. Now, these are the words of P. Morton Shand, who was a food writer, a wine writer, a very influential architectural writer, and also my great-grandfather. His book of food makes really, really good reading. It's fairly trenchant and outspoken. As a person, he was a bit of a shit, let's put it other way. He wasn't a very good father to my grandfather. But anyway, what better way to start than talking about port than P. Morton Shand?
We're starting with something rather close to both our hearts, Portugal. Portugal.
Portugal, I mean, before we get on to Portugal for me is one of the great countries on earth. I must say, two or three times a year, not port related, but Lisbon I love more than any city on earth. It's the light, it's the beauty, it's the food. Cervejaria Ramirez, which is my favourite restaurant in the world. But whenever I'm in Lisbon, I feel happy, whether it's spring, summer, autumn, winter. You know, there's something very underplayed about Portugal and the Portuguese. They're very modest and occasionally melancholic. And then you go up to Porto and the tripe and the salt cod, of course. But for eating and drinking and general loveliness, I don't think you can beat Portugal.
No, you can't. And I have a very long relationship with Portugal. We used to go on holiday to the Algarve, like many British people, every year. My grandfather, my grandmother, my father's side had a flat not far from Portimão. And every year, my father, on the drive from Faro Airport, would expound on the great relationship between the English and the Portuguese, which celebrates its 650th anniversary this year. And it was like there was a direct link from John O'Gaunt's daughter, Philippa, marrying King João of Portugal in 1387, and us turning up with a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label to give to Alessandro, the manager of the Pinina Hotel, so that we could use his swimming pool. That link was very tangible when I was growing up.
We used to go to the Algarve, and one year, this has been about 1997, and we went to Sintra, that wonderful, beautiful, sort of, you know, up in the hills above Lisbon, and we took a very nice house. And it's quite damp there because you're in the clouds up there, and the Algarve's stretching out below you, and this happened in the mid-90s. And anyway, it turned out it was a holiday from hell. My grandmother was very ill, so my grandfather, we took him there, beautiful old house, everything was damp for a start, nightmarish. Secondly, the peak of all these sort of problems with, well, the sort of interest in my mother and all the rest of it, the News of the World had managed to get a journalist in there pretending to be a cook. So that was the next thing. And then my mother kept on saying, I can see glinting, there are cameras in the garden. I don't say stupid, there aren't. Anyway, there were four paparazzi hiding in the garden, one on the roof. So it turned into this absolute holiday from hell. And it's the only bad time I've ever had in Portugal. But that is not Portugal's fault.
That's not Portugal's fault at all. It's a very, very long story to get from the early days of Port to the British tenacity and Christian self-denial, which is what we're going to look at today. It's a story of the oldest, I think it's the oldest alliance in history, which celebrates its 650th anniversary this year between Portugal and England.
Wow. Because it's funny to think, before you get into your learned history of it, Portugal have always, you know, they see themselves as a forgotten country, or they do now, because, you know, you have Spain on one side and you have the Atlantic on the other. And there's a great quote, I think, in this book, which I'll find at some point, basically saying, you know, on one side there's danger and torment and the rest of it, and on the other side there's the Atlantic. So they've always had a identity ever since, you know, the country first began, of not, you know, of Europe, but not quite of Europe sometimes. They were a people apart, you know, this great, great seafaring nation. But I think it's one of the great countries on earth.
And I think we have a lot in common. I think we're both seafaring nations on the edge of Europe, both rather overshadowed sometimes by our larger neighbours, you know, Portuguese with the Spanish, us with the French. And I think we define ourselves against the
of
French.
Course we do. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
And yeah. We're always kind of looking at them thinking, you know, are my trousers right? Mm. We've still got a bit of a chip. I certainly have a bit of a chip on my shoulder about the French.
Funny about the French, because number one, it's the last people, the old enemy, well, not quite the old enemy, that's the Scottish, but it's the last people that were allowed a sort of slightly disrespectful relationship. We sort of love each other, really, but we don't. But yet what we love is when one of our wines, especially a sparkly one, gets voted better than the French, and one of our cheeses gets voted better than the French, we're sticking it to the frog, which, of course, is not a racist thing to say.
No, and it's not really what the podcast is about, because we're looking at a country we've been very good friends with.
Who we love.
Well, we've had our ups and downs, but it really is a very, very long history between the English and the Portuguese. It even goes back beyond the First Alliance, which was in 1373. But we were in Portugal before then. In the 12th century, English soldiers helped the Portuguese throw the Moors out of Portugal in their own Reconquista. In fact, they were English crusaders who were on their way to the Holy Land, stopped off in Portugal, had a go at the Moors, and then picked up a reputation for terrible drunkenness. So there's a very old Portuguese insult, bebado inglês, and we have to apologise, there's going to be lots of bad pronouncing of Portuguese because we're not good at pronouncing Portuguese, but there's a very old insult, bebado inglês, which means English drunk, which is still used to this day, which dates back to the 12th century when drunken English soldiers came along and had a crack at the Moors. So the English-Portuguese story is incredibly ancient.
And fighting aside, that hasn't changed much. We still have a reputation of the wrong sort of drunkenness.
Well, exactly, yes. And in fact, it was noted when, this is jumping ahead a bit, but when the Portuguese were fighting with Wellington in the Peninsula Wars, how sober the Portuguese soldiers were compared with the English soldiers. So Wellington was like, let's have more of these Portuguese soldiers because they don't drink so much, or they can handle their booze better.
I was reading Flashman the other day, and there's a lot of the Peninsula War there, and his views of Portuguese, but Flashy likes the Portuguese. They're our old friends.
So there was an alliance of 1373, and then in 1387, John Agaunt's daughter, Philippa, married King João, or King John, the first of Portugal. So that really cemented the alliance, and the offspring of that was, one of them was Henry the Navigator.
One of the first great Portuguese figures, wasn't he? Sort of a hero.
But he certainly went a hell of a long way.
Yeah. And then going back again to the Portuguese, it is quite incredible. I was reading, and I like to pretend I have this knowledge literally at my fingertips, but reading this rather good book, The Portuguese and Modern History by Barry Hatton, it was about the quality of their ships, of the size of them, the power. The Portuguese were known as a nation of great shipbuilders, you know. And of course, if you have dominance of the seas like that, and they had dominance of the Indian Ocean around about the 14th, 15th century, you're winning.
We should talk about wine, shouldn't we? Mm. Because it is about booze. So obviously Portugal is a wine-growing country, but for most of English history, we'd have been drinking French wine. So Bordeaux was part of England until 1452.
Yeah.
Battle of Castile, I think, that ended the Hundred Years' War. But even after that, wine was Bordeaux. It came over, even though the city didn't belong to England anymore. But this all ended in the 17th century during Cromwell's time. And he came up with a thing called the Navigation Acts. And these actually were aimed at the Dutch.
Yeah.
So the idea was, we've got all these ships. Why are we relying on Dutch ships? So anything that came in on foreign ships had to pay extra taxes. The trouble was the Dutch controlled the claret trade. So most of the claret came in via Dutch ships. So the price of claret went up extraordinarily. So where do you go for wine?
Well, that's the thing. And also, just going back to Cromwell's time, I was reading a book called The Myth of the Finger Post. It came out a few years ago. Anyway, it's fiction. It's set in the time of Cromwell just after. That was just during the Restoration. And of course, the Spanish sat as the middle people because it was the Dutch and the French. And the Spanish, of course, sat in the middle and would take each side because it was a very delicate balancing act, wasn't it, with Charles II?
Yeah.
With the enemies. You had the Dutch, you had the French, you had the Spanish, and they were all conniving and plotting against each other to try and win dominance of the seas, I suppose. So we cannot get from the French. Our Bordeaux goes, where do we look?
Yeah, well, we look to Portugal. And then, you know, you just mentioned Charles II. There's another Portuguese connection there because his wife, Catherine of Braganza, was Portuguese. He kind of leaned towards France. But this sort of problem with, you were mentioning all these kind of rivalries, trade rivalries, imperial rivalries, really came to a head in 1688 when the Glorious Revolution, William of Orange, a Dutchman, became King of England. James II, who was allied with the French, probably a Catholic kind of crypto-Catholic.
Definitely papist in some way or other.
Yeah, yeah. So William III came to the throne, and suddenly you have basically war with France, all-out war with France, and a huge duty was put on French wine. So there was a massive tax on French wine. Obviously, a lot of it would be smuggled and stuff, but basically the price of French wine went through the roof. So where do you go? Oldest alliance, you go to Portugal. So the English merchants, and there was already a sizable merchant community in Porto and in Lisbon, so they would go up country and they would buy wine. And they would buy wine from around the city of Porto. But the problem was that the wine wasn't very good.
Mm.
It was, if people know Portuguese wine today, it was a bit like Vino Verde, except red. So it would
fizzy-ish,
sort of light, low in alcohol, quite high in tannin. Climate in Porto is quite cloudy. It's a bit like sort of San Francisco. So it's not great for producing big, ripe red wines. And it would have been transported in pigskins as well. So it would have tasted piggy. So it was kind of light. And that kind of thing would have been quite nice if you were eating your sardines in Porto Harbour, a light, slightly fizzy red. But, you know, send that for a couple of weeks, couple of months over to England for a bit of hot weather. It's going to be absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, with sort of, as you're going back to that aftertaste of pig, of dead, dead old pig. Yeah.
So people really, really didn't like it. And there were poems about how disgusting it was. There was a poem called Anything But Port, which is about how the person would rather drink anything except port. But I think the best poem is about how the Scots really, really, really didn't take to this new wine. Because the Scots have their own old alliance, don't they?
Yeah.
We have ours with Portugal.
Yeah.
The Scots have it with France. So the Scots were not keen on this new Portuguese wine. There were rumours that port was a plot to hit the Highlanders where it really hurt, under the kilt. So I'm just going to read this poem in my best Scots accent, which I'm allowed to do because my mother's from Aberdeen. Firm and erect the Caledonian stood. Sound was his mutton and his claret was good. Let him drink port, the English statesman cried. He drank the poison and his spirit died. The Scots really, really didn't like this new wine. But at the same time, they were quite involved with the port trade. A lot of the early port shippers...
Canny Scots.
Were canny Scots.
Yeah, indeed.
So the Sandemans from Perth, the Grahams.
Were they? So the great families actually were Scottish, not English.
Coburn, I think that's... isn't that a Scottish name?
I wouldn't know, gosh.
I'll have to turn to the Scottish section of our well-prepared cream sheet. So this wine really wasn't very good, but there was better wine or better grapes growing on the other side of the mountains. So Porto, rainy city, on the Atlantic, you go into the mountains and the climate is quite different. So you go up the Douro into the mountains and it's baking hot in the summer, freezing cold in the winter. And it was just a different world. And the grapes that were grown there by sort of peasant farmers, monks, that kind of stuff, was thick, ripe, red wine. You know, the kind of thing that...
Big punch.
Yeah, it's going to get Englishmen excited, and Scotsmen as well, and Irishmen, in fact. So there were Irish in the trade, and Welshmen too. So, you know, North Europeans in rainy little islands, they loved these.
But it wasn't in those days a question of getting onto a rather comfortable barge and going up the Douro and eating, drinking and getting to the vineyards. It was quite, I mean, it wasn't quite going through the Amazon, but it was quite arduous, wasn't it? From Porto up, cutting through in the early days of getting there. It was no picnic.
It was no picnic. I mean, today you go there and they've dammed the Douro. Yeah. So it's this tranquil lake and there's a rather charming little train that winds its way up and there's a proper motorway and stuff. But you'd had to go up by donkey and it could have taken months. And there were kind of, you know, wild bandits and vermin and wolves and things like that. So it was quite arduous, but it must have been worth it because the wines that came back sold for a lot of money. But coming back was even more dangerous because they'd come back via the river, but it was rapids and they were on these little boats called rabelos.
There's a sort of flat bottom, do they?
Flat bottom. They look a bit like little Viking longships.
Okay, yeah.
And they go down the door and they would be loaded up with huge pipes. A pipe is a 550-litre cask, so huge.
And they would be at this stage wooden. They wouldn't be in pigskins.
They were in cask.
Okay. It was like all the beginning of all great things. There was a bit of derring do and sort of danger in there, wasn't there?
There was. So under Cromwell, there was a 1654 treaty which gave the merchants in Porto and Lisbon privileges. They were almost like a sort of colonial power who didn't have to obey Portuguese law. So that was the 1654 treaty. But things became even closer after the end of Cromwell. So we had the Restoration. You know, things got a bit jollier. The theatres opened. Charles II, you know, a bit of a roustabout.
Yeah.
Amazing hair. Lots of mistresses came to the throne.
Although, funny enough, I never realised, I was reading a book the other day about Cromwell, and you assume he's very, very dour and Presbyterian. Well, not Presbyterian, he's English. But the whole point of Puritanism wasn't that you couldn't drink. It's just that you couldn't drink to drunkenness. So he was a big drinker, Cromwell. And you'd imagine him as teetotal and pretty boring. But actually, he could hold his booze.
He got famously drunk at his daughter's wedding.
Yes, exactly,
and was sort of dancing on the tables and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the other people in the new model army, they rather frowned upon this.
Bloody Puritans, yeah.
Bloody Puritans. No, that's a very good point. Puritans, keen on drinking, not keen on drunkenness.
Not drunkenness, yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't like the theatre, though, did they?
No, oh God, no. So, or Christmas.
Or Christmas. Charles II, who loved the theatre, drunkenness, Christmas, ladies, you know, all the good things in life, came to the throne in 1660, and he married Catherine of Braganza, who was Portuguese.
So this was a big union.
The union was already pretty cemented, and this was kind of stapling it to even stronger. And she brought with her the most amazing dowry in history, which included Bombay.
Well, hey.
Which means, I think it means good harbour or something like that in Portuguese.
Those were the days.
So it started the new British Empire. You know, Britain had a few colonies in America, but it gave England a foothold in India.
We offered protection as well, because our fleet at that point, we were the bigger seafaring network. This is right. This is before East India Company and all that,
is before England was sort of on the cusp of that kind of greatness.
Yeah.
I think Portugal was probably still the senior power, because you know, they had Brazil. They had kind of colonies in West Africa and stuff. Portugal was a superpower for such a tiny country. So Catherine of Braganza, so that was probably the greatest dowry in history, if you're going to get Bombay. And then Charles II, he died, and he was succeeded by James II. And Charles leant towards France. He was pretty keen on Catholicism, I think. Didn't he convert to Catholicism on his deathbed?
I don't know, but you do know that he was, you know, because the days of Cromwell and the papists being, you know, scum and the enemy and the rest of it, and it moves slowly, doesn't it? He certainly, when he came into power, he was very forgiving of a lot of the papists, you know, and I suppose that it was the dominant religion.
Yes, and obviously Catherine of Braganza, being Portuguese, was Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And so James II came along, and he was a bit less subtle in his kind of pro-Rome, pro-French beliefs. And he was overthrown in 1688 by William of Orange, a Dutchman, in the Glorious Revolution, who a sort of little invasion.
Yeah.
William was supported by Parliament, who were generally pro-Portuguese and sort of anti-French. And it ushered in 1688 kind of on and off war with France that lasted until, well, the defeat of Napoleon. Mm. So it was longer than the Hundred Years' War. Britain was antagonistic towards France, which was bad for wine drinkers.
Yeah.
So where are you going to go to get your wine?
Well, Portugal. And again, at this point, the Scottish families, all these famous port families, they were sort of making initial forays in, you know, in Porto, travelling up country, getting to where it is, bringing the wine back, realising not just that there's good wine there, but there's money to be made. I think that's where, as usual with anything, any trade, lots of money to be made.
But the early wines didn't impress, did they? So what were the English swapping the wine for? Because they didn't just turn up with the load of cash, did they?
We had access in back in those days to the massively abundant fishing grounds of Nova Scotia. You could walk across the sea, you know, on the heads of all the cod there. And cod became, you know, there's been that Mark Lansky book on cod. It's the fish that allowed empire to happen, because without drying that salt cod and being able to subsist and exist long times at sea, it's an incredible ingredient. There's this whole sort of swapping, wasn't it? We also had wool that the Portuguese wanted from us. So back then we had control of those very, very, very abundant fishing grounds of Nova Scotia with the cod. And what happened is that we swapped our wool for cod. The cod was salted, went over to Portugal. And with that cod, we bought wine. There we go.
There we go. And
wool to cod to wine.
And the Portuguese love salt cod. You know, it's not something we eat a lot of here. But you go to Porto and it's like 100 ways with salt cod. And if you ever stay with the sort of port families, they go, "We've got a special treat for you. It's bacalhau," which is salt cod. But the food in Porto is kind of magnificently stodgy, isn't it? And I think this is another reason why we get on so well with the Portuguese. We love that sort of heavy, starchy food.
There's that thing about Porto, especially when you come from Lisbon, which is all beautiful clear light and the sun glittering off the Tagus and all that wonderful, those sort of pastel colours and blah, blah. And you get up to Porto and it's, yeah, you know that old rivalry between Lisbon and Porto. It's Lisbon play, we make the money. You know, we pay the taxes, Lisbon spend it. You know, there's this whole thing that Lisbon's seen as sort of carefree and doesn't work hard and it's all sunny. The real heft and hard work, solid, hard toil is done in Porto. And as you say, that food, lots of croquettes, lots of salt cod. There's that wonderful, is it called Francesina, which is one of the great drunken sandwiches of all time, which is monolithic. It's like something out of Utah Valley. It's this vast, massive lump of carbohydrate and dairy, you know, sort of cheese.
It's like a croque monsieur on steroids, isn't it? And then they cover it in a kind of beer and spicy sauce.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, you do need a knife and fork and you do feel pretty ill afterwards. But late night, after a night out in Porto and you go and have one of those, it's just fantastic. But all those, very good tripe as well. They're called the tripe eaters as well of Portugal. Yeah. You get that wonderful white bean, tripe, tomato, very delicate.
I think it's time for a break.
Definitely time for a break.
And so port, cod, wool, and this was all cemented in an alliance called the Methuen Treaty, very famous, 1703, which ushered in a sort of golden age of port wine, which was very different to the local Porto wine. This was something from up country. This was from beyond the hills, where it was baking hot in the summer, freezing cold in the winter, and the grapes got very, very ripe, produced this wonderful dark wine that the English called blackstrap. And it was it was hard to get, because nowadays, you've been there, the Douro is this tranquil lake. It's been dammed.
You go sort of slowly sailing up.
You get lots of old people on boats, you know. Yes. It's a great thing to do when you've retired. Go up the Douro. It wasn't like that in the 18th century. It was rapid. It was a ferocious river. You couldn't go up it. You had to take donkeys over the hills, and there were bandits and vermin and wolves and freezing cold temperatures and baking hot temperatures. And, you know, you had to be pretty hardy to do it. And no wonder the trade is overrepresented by Scots and Yorkshiremen, you know.
Yeah.
Hardy people. Yeah. So these hardy northerners went over and they came back with wine that would have been made by a peasant. Some of it may have been made by monasteries. Thick, dark wine that had brought it back to Porto. And then they all set up warehouses opposite the main city on the other side of the Douro. So it's called Vila Nova de Gaia. And that meant they didn't have to follow all the rules of the city. They didn't have to pay all the taxes in the city. So they had, and they're all still there. You can see Graham, Sandeman, Croft, you know, Fonseca, all these glorious names. They still have their warehouses at Vila Nova de Gaia.
But at what point did, and this is the crucial point, you had the thin Porto wines, you had these wonderful wines coming up from up north. At what point did these wines, these peasant wines, that obviously had the extremes of temperature that gave the flavour and intensity, when did that become the port that we perhaps might recognise now, that isn't just a wine, it's something
yes,
more?
Yes, but it's not entirely clear what ancient port or very old port would have tasted like. It probably would have been a dry wine. Most of the time it would have been fermented to dryness, so there would have been no sugar in it, though some monasteries were in the habit of adding aguardiente, which is grape brandy, to the fermenting grapes, which would have killed the yeast and you would have got a sweet wine. But that was called priest's port, and that was quite unusual. Most port would have been dry, probably about 16%, and then would have been fortified with brandy to help it travel. So sometimes it wouldn't be entirely stable. Maybe it would still be fermenting a bit. Cleanliness wasn't what it is now. It might have sort of bacteria. It's very hard to make wine in very hot weather.
Yeah.
Because the ferments get out of control, you get bacteria and stuff, which is nowadays why most people use temperature-controlled fermentation, where you have like a pipe of water going around the fermenting vats, without getting too technical.
Yeah.
But you didn't have that in those days. So sometimes the fermentation may not have finished properly or may have been a bit rough. So you'd add brandy to it. The idea is, it stabilizes.
It was a purely practical measure to be able to get it, stabilize it and get it transported over vast distances. So it's not, oh, it'll taste nice if we add some brandy to it. It was purely a practical thing to get this product from one country to another and keep it the same.
Perhaps, yes, but also the English liked it strong.
Okay.
So I think there was probably people back in London who were, if you just gave them some unfortified port, I'm sure some of it was unfortified, would have gone, I don't like this. Yeah. I want, put some aguardiente, stick some brandy in it. That's what we want.
And at this point, port wasn't an after-dinner drink. It wasn't. This was very much something you'd have a pint of port when you go to, you wouldn't go to a coffee shop, you'd go to a tavern and you'd have, would you get it by, and the pints were smaller then, weren't they?
They would have come in pint bottles. So okay, I think the Imperial, I think you're right. I think the pint, this is going off on a bit of a tangent.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't the American pint, the old pint, and then our pint got bigger.
Okay.
Became the Imperial pint.
Right.
But it would have been about half a litre, the bottles.
But they would be drinking that with their mutton chops, with their peas puddings.
No, port was the wine.
Many a pint of port, wouldn't they?
Yes. So we mentioned before how even though some Scots weren't very keen on port initially, the trade was overrepresented by hardy Scots. But there were also certain Scots and also people in Britain who really didn't like port, not because they didn't like the taste, but because it symbolised something they didn't like. Port became political.
The English, that's what it symbolised.
Well, the Protestant English.
Yes,
you know,
yes. Not...
There was a sort of culture war going on. You know, we're all aware of culture wars these days. This one was port assumed became a factor in the culture war between sort of Catholics, Stuarts, Jacobites, so people who supported James and his descendants, Bonnie Prince Charlie and all those sort of people, they were allied with the French. And they drank claret.
Well, the king over the water, yeah.
The king over the water. Yeah. Whereas the Hanoverians, Lowland Scots, canny, businesslike, Protestant Scots.
Dour,
sensible Scots.
Yes.
They drank port. You could buy drinking glasses that showed your allyship with the Jacobite cause, so everyone would know. And this kind of strange thing persisted until very, very recently. There's a great bit in David Niven's The Moon's a Balloon.
I love that. It's a very good autobiography.
If you haven't read it, it's probably one of the funniest books ever written. But he served in a Highland regiment, and at dinners, they were drinking port by this stage, but they would put the port glass over their glass of water to symbolise the king over the water, which he thought was rather puerile, didn't he?
Yeah, ostentatiously passed over the top of a glass of water on the way to the lips in a rather juvenile gesture to show the Highlanders were still drinking to the exiled Stuarts, the king of the water. On that thing, talking of the glass of etiquette, I remember growing up, I think port, you could only pass it to the left. Or was it? Yes, it was. You passed the port after dinner to the left. Now, whether or is it to the right? It's definitely to the left, which is strange because left is always sinister. Sinistra is always a sign of the devil, you know. So whether or not that comes from superstition of some kind, I don't know, whether it's some toff ritual, but it was very clear growing up that it was always passed to the left port as it came around after dinner. It's just going back to all these ancient and arcane rituals that port have or has.
And what's wonderful today is you go to a port house and they still do it. They still do the, and their meals in the right order. So they have pudding and then cheese. You know, the French are cheese and then pudding. The Portugal does it so you can linger over the port and the cheese.
And then, of course, the British have the savoury, which is even better. It gets rid of the fripperies of pudding and just gets a nice sort of something salty and cheesy and robust on toast to, you know, before you move on to the fripperies of pudding, I think someone said once. But anyway, that's a whole different thing.
Because, I mean, that tradition is still going at... Have you been to the Factory House in Porto? The port shippers, as they were known, they were called shippers because they just used to ship. They didn't actually make their own wine. They'd go up country, buy the wine, and then ship it. They had a thing called the Factory House, which was in Porto proper, not in Vila Nova. And it's a wonderful building. It looks a bit like a slice of Cheltenham or Bath that's just landed.
Oh, it was Regency buildings.
It's pure Georgian.
Yeah.
So it's sort of pillars and it's absolutely magnificent. And they still have dinners there, you know, where they obviously pass the port the right way and frown upon people who pass it the wrong way. And I had to actually give a talk there once and it was honestly the most terrifying thing I've ever done. So I was sitting at a table with all these British and Portuguese port people who knew far more about the stuff than I did. And I was like basically telling them stuff that they already knew, but worse. Nerve-wracking stuff.
Do you do it in Portuguese?
that would have been... I think they would have been deeply impressed if I did it in Portuguese. And what's interesting is that, you know, despite this great friendship officially between the two countries, the actual Portuguese and English and Scots, they didn't really mix very much. They stayed very, very separate.
That was in your book. That's very interesting, that, yeah.
And I think part of that is linguistic because Portuguese is a difficult language. But then again, the English would learn Urdu and Hindustani and Persian and stuff when they were in India.
The Nawabs and
They you know, they went completely native and they would be there, you know, dressed in sort of Mughal clothing and stuff. Whereas in Portugal, which is you'd think of as much closer culturally, they didn't mix at all. And they kept sort of very, very separate lives. And the Portuguese were Catholic. They were often, I think they looked down on the English as being sort of middle-class traders.
Oh, there's no snob like a Portuguese snob, apart from a Spanish snob. Right. But, you know, if you see the very grand Portuguese, they are so observant of sort of, you know, doing the right thing and saying the right thing and manners and all the way. They're very, they're often like sort of a certain type of Englishman 50 years ago. They're very, aren't they, very... doing things right.
And they still dress like that.
Oh,
you'll see them
dressed,
in beautiful tweed, except much better cut than anything that an Englishman would have. Because they don't sort of realise that the whole point is that your jacket you inherited from your great-grandfather and has spent most of its life in the back of a Volvo 240 with Labradors climbing on. They didn't do that. They went to the best tailor in Lisbon and got their tweed suit done properly.
Yeah, immaculately dressed.
So the Portuguese and English, but I mean, they do now. All the English families, they now all speak perfect Portuguese. Well, maybe, I don't know if it's perfect, but it sounds pretty good to me. In these days, they didn't mix at all. When I first went to Porto, I was a guest of Sandemann, who are now owned by a Portuguese company, but they are still managed, or when I went there, they were still managed by a George Sandemann, who is a direct descendant of George Sandemann from Perth, Scotland, not Perth, Australia. And he was one of the sort of pioneering port shippers. And he became friends with Wellington. So the two of them enjoyed vintage port during the Peninsular Wars.
Wow. So he was a steady drinker, wasn't he? He wasn't a drunkard by any stretch of imagination, but he knew the power of importance of drink to his troops as well, I think.
He did, yes. So Sandemann drank port with the Duke of Wellington. They tried the 1794 vintage, which was pronounced the finest ever known. And then the 1815 vintage was apparently a wonderful vintage, the Waterloo vintage. And I think this event in the development of the Anglo-Portuguese alliance, because a lot of Wellington's army was Portuguese, and it was the Portuguese who marched very, very soberly into France. Mm. And eventually they got to the city of Bordeaux, and the mayor of Bordeaux, who was an Irishman, well, of Irish descent, called John Lynch, from Lynch Barge, who had fled Ireland after the Battle of the Bulge. The Battle of the Boyne. His family had become big in Bordeaux. But then when the Anglo-Portuguese army turned up in the city of Bordeaux, Mayor Lynch came out, handed him the keys, the best customers were back, you know, bit of a tangent there, but kind of shows how the history of drink all sort of ties up and echoes.
Nowadays, you know, port is so has a reputation as a certain type of red-faced, florid face. We're going to the cliches of the wine trade and of gentlemen's clubs and passing the port and gout. If I ask my children, actually, they're not old enough really to know about anything, to be honest, they're 15. But if I ask a certain generation, a couple below us, about port, it hasn't had the marketing spin that lots of other drinks have managed to sort of, you know, appreciate and love by the people who know, but it's still yet to, you know, let's think of sherry. Sherry had a massive sort of clever remarketing and rebranding over the last 25 years, and suddenly Fino and Manzanilla, it's very cool for young people to be sipping it. We haven't reached that point on port yet, have we?
No, we haven't. But I suppose, I mean, port was so extraordinarily big in the 18th and 19th
century.
How
big? I mean, it was the drink.
It was like, I think something like a third of wines imported into England would have been, in the 19th century, would have been port. And okay. For most people, port was wine. And when they started making wine in Australia in the 19th century, they made some table wines, but basically they made Empire Port, and they made with different grapes. So port was kind of unimaginably big in a way we can't really comprehend today. It's sort of almost never really needed to market itself. Probably could do with it now. But it was the drink of the upper classes, the upper middle classes.
So it wasn't taverns. You weren't roistering about in a tavern with a wench with a pint of port.
Well, you could be. I'm sure there were cheaper wines, but generally it was quite an upmarket wine. It would have been drunk by, you know, your squires, your merchants, your aristocracy and stuff. You know, people like William Pitt the Younger.
Yeah.
Used to have a pint of port before appearing in the House of Commons.
I mean, the thought of a pint of port, I'm literally sweating fear, just the thought of a whole pint. Because, you know, those hangovers that do occasionally occur where it's probably not the port to blame, but it is the final nail in the coffin when, you have that one more glass of port and you feel it the next day, I tell you.
It wouldn't have been quite as severe as you'd imagine, because port nowadays is 20%. This would have been probably about 15, 16%.
So like a really big, heavy red.
Like having like a pint of Australian Shiraz or something. So those three bottle men, you know, there was that famous thing in the 18th century, three bottle men, they drank three bottles of port a day. And that's, you know, that's a lot, but it's not 375 centilitres of 20% wine.
Well, you've got your quote, Samuel Johnson. I've drunk three bottles of port without being the worse for it. University College has witnessed this. I mean, yeah. Shall we take a break and have a little drink?
Bien sûr.
So what have we here, Henry?
So this is Taylor's 10-year-old tawny. So this is a very different style to vintage port, LBV, that kind of stuff. Those ones which major on fresh fruit character. Tawny's a little bit different. So what they do is they get lots of wine and they age it in these kind of smallish barrels. So they're sort of 500 litres. And there's a little bit of oxygen in the top. So the wine very gently oxidizes. So if you look at that color and compare it with...
It's slightly rusty, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a tawny color, which is why they call it a tawny.
So there we go. That was my question answer.
Yeah, so it loses its color and it takes on these incredible kind of flavours of, well, let's have a smell and think about what it tastes like.
See, for me, the smell now is beginning to remind me of the port I knew growing up. You know, the sort of rather traditional... big, slightly brandied.
So I get a kind of cooked strawberry, a sort of almost like a strawberry jam, maybe a bit of orange peel, something like that.
It's more grown up, magisterial. It's not quite as sort of, it doesn't frolic.
You don't think it frolics? I think it's quite frolicky.
Not quite as frolicky as the LBV, though. It's got a bit of heft to it. It's seen a bit of the world, I think.
No, it has definitely seen a bit of the world. So it's a 10-year-old, so it's a blend of different wines to 10 years old. And they all sit there in their barrels at Villa Nova de Gaia, which is where the warehouses are opposite the city of Porto. And they blend it. So they blend it into rather like a malt whiskey, into a consistent product. So you have, I think it's David Gimmerens, who is the winemaker at Taylor. So he'll go around kind of sniffing casks and sort of that one. So the idea is it doesn't change. Every year, the Taylor's 10-year-old is the same.
But it's still a lot lighter. I mean, it's served chilled. Is that the right thing to do?
That's how they do it in Porto. So traditionally, this style was more popular with the Portuguese. So the English, they like the British, they like their
warm
vintage
and
port,
heavy, yeah.
You know, heavy, one for a Dickensian winter.
Yes.
Whereas in the heat of the Douro, you'd have this chilled, often with
queijo de serra, you know, the that lovely cheese yep. that you get, maybe some ham, that kind of stuff.
But I remember being in Porto, and Porto is that wonderful grey city. If Lisbon's all full of jollity, you know, they will say that in Porto they work and in Lisbon they spend the money. But I was sitting eating a delicious tripe dish, that wonderful tripe dish of Porto, looking over at Taylor's, over the river. And this, I had a glass of this and it went very well with tripe.
Yeah, it does it. I mean, I can't even imagine drinking this with tripe. This is, it's got a stopper in the top, so you don't need a corkscrew or anything like that, and it's sold absolutely ready to drink. So they take it all out of the barrels and they blend it and they bottle it, and you really just want to, you don't need to age it. In fact, you probably shouldn't age it because it loses some of that freshness. But because it's been aged with oxygen contact, an open bottle will last a month, no problem at all.
Really?
Not that it does in our house, because my wife is addicted to Taylor's 10-year-old, but it won't deteriorate.
And would it be frightfully involved to make a cocktail? When you're in Porto, what are those cocktails you have with the port? Is it a port and sort of soda? Or
there's a white port and tonic, which is delicious. But this, put it in a Negroni instead of vermouth.
Wow.
And you have what I call a Christmas Negroni. It's absolutely sensational.
Wow, you'd have the Italian purists going mad over that, but it tastes probably...
It tastes wonderful because you've got that lovely kind of walnutty finish. So it makes the Negroni, which is, you know, like big bang flavours, it gives it a kind of length and subtlety that wasn't there before.
That's almost revelatory, that drink. Very, very good.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I think it's time for a break.
Let's have a short break.
The prize for the rowdiest port drinker goes to a Shropshire squire called John Mitten, who drank between 4 and 6 bottles of port a day. I mean, even at 15%,
that's quite... And these were pints?
These would have been pints.
Yeah.
He was thought to have been permanently drunk for most of his adult life. He once set fire to his nightshirt in order to cure hiccups. I mean, we've all done that, haven't we?
Yeah, obviously.
Who hasn't done that? When he arrived at Cambridge University, he took 2,000 bottles of port with him. He left without any port or a degree. Briefly MP for Shrewsbury, he was more famous for his drunken exploits. And this is a quote from Mitten's biographer, Charles James Appley. Appley wrote, "He, Mitten, once rode this bear into his drawing room in full hunting costume. The bear carried him very quietly for a time, but on being pricked by the spur, he bit his rider through the calf of his leg." And then Mitten died, as you can imagine, quite young, 37, penniless. He'd spent it all on port. So, you know, that is the danger, picking up a port habit.
And you go back and you look through, you know, the literature, Dickens and I suppose Thackeray, and it is still, like you say, it's country squires drinking their port, it's lords, but going into sort of Evelyn Waugh, Brideshead, you know, all those sort of clubs, drinking clubs, they're always getting absolutely squazzled on port. Bertie Wister, I'm sure, would at some point get stuck in it. It still does have that reputation as a gentleman's drink.
It does, doesn't it?
You know, it's not like 10 pints of Stella and on you go. It's always had... So has it always been quite expensive?
I think it's always been quite
relatively
expensive, yeah. We'll come on to this. This is quite interesting because at one point in the 18th century, the English merchants were being a bit naughty. They were adulterating because it was the sort of killing of the golden goose. So they had this wine, everyone loved it, they're getting it right, and they were like, let's bastardise it.
Yeah.
So they started adding elderberries, which give a lot of colour and tannin. They started just beefing it up with brandy, adding like more brandy than they really should, and creating this kind of Frankenport that really, really wasn't very good. And then when customers didn't like it, they blamed the growers up in the Douro and said, they're the ones who've been putting the elderberries in, it wasn't us. This caused a huge diplomatic problem. This was during war with France, so the English needed the Portuguese. So the Prime Minister of Portugal was a chap called, and I'm going to pronounce this so badly, so really sorry, Portuguese listeners, Sebastião José de Carvalho e Melo, better known as the Marquis of Pombal. And he did not like all this adulterating by the British shippers, so he came up with an answer to this, which would be that all farmers upcountry in the Douro would have to sell their wine to a company. This is, again, I'm going to do some bad Portuguese pronunciation. The company called the Companhia Geral de Agricultura e Vinhos do Alto Douro, henceforth known as the Company. So rather than dealing directly with the British, they would have to sell to this kind of monopoly, which would then resell the wine to the British shippers.
And he was quite clever, wasn't he, with the boundaries of the port region, because his land was very much within those boundaries.
It was, yes. Yeah, no, so there was, it was the first time a government had demarcated. So long time before Appellation Controles or anything like that, he set the boundaries of the port region, and they did it like so that his vineyards were in there as well. So, you know, he was in some ways quite corrupt, but also managed to regain the reputation of port wine. And the company had three grades of port. It had domestic, which was the lowest grade, Brazil, which was the next, and the highest grade went to Britain and the burgeoning British Empire. And the British shippers, they hated him. And I think it could have caused a diplomatic incident, but because England needed Portugal because of war with France, the British government just ignored the shippers and said, just get on with it. And they did. And it led to a sort of golden age for port. But what's interesting is this demarcating of the regions, because one of the things that he said was that the planting of elderberry bushes within this region was a capital offence.
Really?
Yeah.
And was anyone ever killed?
Well, I don't know, actually. So if anyone knows whether anyone was actually had their head chopped off
for
planting elderflower bushes in the port region, then let us know. Which reminds me of that quote from the Holy Grail, you know, Monty Python's Grail, which was, you know, your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries. Perhaps a grave insult. Perhaps it's the father was a wine adulterer.
Oh, well, of course. And again, a capital offence is, gosh, look at that.
So Pombal, for all his, you know, undoubted corruption, I mean, he did throw loads of people in prison and probably make an absolute killing out of the whole thing, did regain the reputation of port, which had been rather ruined for a time.
So up to this point, we're talking about port as a dry wine, not the sweet one we know now.
Almost certainly. It would have been, there may have been some sweet wines. There may have been some that were sort of half sweet, you know, because the fermentation hadn't finished properly because hot climate, you know, yeast struggling, brandy added too early. But generally it would have been, I suppose, not dissimilar to a modern Douro table wine, probably not quite as refined. And I mean, what they discovered is initially it would have been drunk quite young, but they discovered with the bottles, which were improving the whole time, and they designed them for lying down, that if you left it in a bottle for 5 years, 10 years, because you know what young vintage port like, it's fiery, it's tannic, it's, you know, it's quite hard work. You leave that for 5-10 years, it turns into something rather refined, rather mellow. So people were beginning to become connoisseurs of this wine. So the 1820 vintage, this was a landmark vintage. The grapes got so ripe, so much sugar, that the wines didn't finish fermentation. The yeasts just were like, no, I can't deal with this. So they added the brandy, there was still lots of sugar, and they shipped it, and everybody loved it. Everyone was like, this is the wine.
Wow.
So after that, it became routine to add the aguardiente, the brandy, during fermentation, killing the yeasts, creating a sweet wine. So gradually, port, the sweet port, which had been a sort of anomaly, became the standard port. But not everyone liked that. You had your kind of port hipsters who sort of said that, you know, things were better in the old days.
Yeah,
you know?
They always do, don't they? Yeah. So, but I mean, that's fascinating. So this drink that was a third of all the wine drunk in our country, it was dry. So you wouldn't be tasting the brandy so much in there. It wouldn't be, you know, the difference between the claret, the burgundy and the port was quite pronounced.
Oh, yeah, they would have been hugely different.
But
yeah.
The British still have this reputation of liking the heavy, big, and most important of all, strong wines.
They do. They loved port so much that they used to stick it in claret. So the merchants of London, they'd get their barrel of Leoville Barton or something like that. And they'd be like, wow, this is a bit thin, isn't it? You know? So they would put a bottle of port in. That was standard. That was making it better. And Jefferson, the Thomas Jefferson, he used to complain about this and used to try and buy his wine direct. So he was a wine hipster.
And he was also a great gardener and a great cook as well, by all accounts. Jefferson, he liked his food.
He did. He liked his wine and he wanted it pure. So he used to buy it direct from the chateau before they'd stuck some port in.
Because he worked, I think he worked in Paris, didn't he, when he was young? Of course, Jefferson in Paris, you're thinking of the book. He was a great Francophile, Jefferson. And there was a man bringing in claret way back into America. Also the cheeses he loved, because you know, in those days it was punishable by death to export certain things from France. And I think that, hell was it? There was some seeds he took, and I can't remember what they were. But anyway, there we go, we're digressing. But Jefferson liked his food and drink.
He did. And so Jefferson didn't like adulterated wine. There was another chap who really didn't like it, another wine hipster, who was a chap called Joseph James Forrester. And he was a very unusual British shipper, because not only did he speak Portuguese, but he sort of allied himself with the Portuguese and was eventually made a baron. So he was known as Baron Forrester, but he wasn't a British baron. He was a Portuguese baron. And he didn't like these new sweet ports. He thought they were ghastly. So he wrote a rather long-winded pamphlet called A Word or Two on Port Wine, showing how and why it is adulterated and affording some means of checking adulteration. So in this very long-winded pamphlet, I mean, it shows that kind of classic Victorian English you were talking about, the P. Morton Shand. So he complained that port is now a nauseous, fiery compound of sweets, colours and alcohol. So this was writing in 1844, when I think that ship had sailed. Most people thought of port as a sweet wine. And the very oldest port I've ever had, which was an 1863
wow.
ship by Taylor's. And it had been in cask for, I don't know how long, you know, 50 years or something. Maybe even been longer. That was sweet. I mean, that was definitely sweet.
Would people at this point, we're talking mid-19th century now, would people be drinking it after dinner? Was it still very much a digestif rather than as it was 200 years before, a table wine?
You know? I think they were still drinking it throughout the meal.
So you drink it in big glasses.
No. If you think of Master and Commander.
Yes,
you know, when
yes,
they're there
yes,
with
yes.
their little glasses. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
So they're there. They've got beautiful port glasses, those beautiful tiny little ones.
Yeah.
And it was very strong. So they'd be drinking it out of tiny little glasses, but, you know, topping up. And that's why it was being passed around. So it was just, you sipped it. But you sipped a lot of it.
Yeah, it was. God, that's a good film, Master and Commander.
It really is.
I watched it again and again. It's a masterpiece. I wish they'd film some more of those.
We should do a program on drinking in Master and Commander in Patrick O'Brien.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read Patrick O'Brien for years, but it's very much any book about the Navy in those days. I suppose it was rum. The officers drunk port, and then they would get their tot of rum, wouldn't they, every day? The British Navy, which only stopped in, I think, 79 or something.
It was Black Tot Day, 1970.
That was the last day.
So they were, you know, manning these huge dreadnoughts, you know, like nuclear submarines.
Drunk
and stuff,
skunks,
you know, whilst drinking rum.
And a tot was a big whack. But again, going back to the Master Commander days and going back to those, I just read a brilliant book, and it's called The Wager by David Gran, who wrote Lost City of Zed, and it's about a British vessel going off round the Cape of Good Hope at the bottom of South America and getting to attack the Spanish, you know, because of the old enemy. And of course, on board with all their pork and their chickens and all the rest of it, there'd be huge amounts of booze because the whole British Navy ran on booze. But anyway, when it's
no, it did. I think that's a really good topic for a programme. But so Baron Forrester, the port purist, port hipster, whatever you want to call him. When I went to Taylor's, they have this beautiful map in their sort of museum. And it was produced by Baron Forrester. And he was the first person to map the whole Douro. So the whole course of the river, all the vineyards, the Douro Superiore, all that sort of stuff. So he was an incredible figure in the history of port. He also sort of catalogued grape varieties before no one would have a clue what they had. And so he was an incredible figure in turning port from this sort of, you know, could be anything, vineyards here, vineyards there, to these are the best properties, these are the best vineyards, this is the best climate, these are the best grapes. So he was someone almost like a sort of Dom Perignon type figure in Champagne, someone who mapped the land and turned it into something systematic rather than something slightly random, which is how it had been before. But he came to a watery end. We were talking about the Douro River,
yeah.
The treacherous Douro River. And he was on one of those little barges laden with port, Rebelos, and the barge overturned. And apparently he had lots of money bags with him because he was so good at selling port, and he drowned. But also on that barge was a very important lady called Donna Antonia Ferreira, and she was wearing the fashionable crinolines of the time, which meant that she floated. So there's this sort of story that the Portuguese tell of her floating down the river with her friends with their crinolines, and poor old Baron Forrester, money bags Forrester,
sinking to the bottom.
I love these stories. They're often apocryphal, but they're lovely and romantic. I mean, was she definitely on the same boat?
Oh, she was definitely on the same boat, yes. And she was a sort of hugely important figure, you know, almost as important as, well, perhaps as important as Baron Forrester in the port industry. And there's still a port house to this day, Ferreira. And she was known as Ferreirinha, so I suppose little Ferreira, the diminutive. And that's what the table wines are called. And this company makes Portugal's grandest table wine, which is called Barça Veia. But she was a married to a hopeless husband who spent her fortune, and she was widowed at 33. And then she took over running the family estates and did all kinds of things, like help with the welfare of workers and helped battle phylloxera, which was this terrible vine-eating louse that came.
At this point, no one knew about it.
No one knew what it was. So she helped replant the Douro with a phylloxera-resistant rootstocks, which was a technique that was pioneered in France. But we probably don't need to go into much detail about phylloxera, but it was this nasty bug, came from the east coast of America. Native American vines were resistant to it. It came to France, destroyed Bordeaux, destroyed Burgundy, destroyed Champagne, came over, destroyed, you know, Spain, and then Portugal.
Wow.
And then she kind of helped save the Douro by replanting with resistant rootstocks. So hugely important figure. And she also fought for the enlargement of the Douro region, so the region that had been mapped out by Pombal, to include the Douro Superiore, which is home to Quinto do Vesuvio, which is a great vineyard, which is now part of the Symington family estate, I believe. Let's see if I've got that one right. This isn't a politics podcast, but I think it's very sad that the government have just revamped the duty and put it up on fortified wines like port to £4.30 a bottle.
It's a half-witted, knee-jerk reaction to keep beer cheap because they think that's the thing and hammer everything else.
It's a betrayal of the old alliance.
Yeah, and also it's unthinking. They don't even speak to anyone in booze and strip. Anyway, this is a whole different thing. I mean, I remember always, you know, you were sort of grown up when you were allowed at dinner parties, you'd be, not dinner parties, you'd be off shooting somewhere in Yorkshire or with your father and your mother and you'd dinner and you'd be black tie. And at that point where, you know, pudding was over, the ladies would go off into the drawing room to talk about ladylike things and the men would be left to put the world to rights. And it would be over creme de menthe or port or some other sort of nefarious spirit. But, you know, when you were allowed to sit with the grown-ups and have port, and obviously when you're about 15, 16, you were hooning it back, trying to get as much down as you could. And I remember having rather an excess of port. And yeah, it's one of those, a port hangover is not one to be forgotten, I think.
It's not, no. But I think people don't really drink enough port. I think it's tremendous value for money. You can get a port that's really as good as any other wine for £15-20 a bottle. Like this is, you know, this is not an expensive wine. So I think part of the reason why the British in particular, but also the Scandinavians, the Irish, have taken to port is because it's a little bit of sunshine in our gloomy, rain-strewn islands. And it's a way of bottling the heat of the Douro and having it in a glass. So, you know, you're up in Scotland, it's freezing, the central heating doesn't work, you can't afford to turn it on. Open a bottle of port and you've got that sensational sunshine.
Do you find that this is a rather generalised theory that I have, that the further you get north, the less light there is, the colder it is, the more we drink to get drunk rather than drink for pleasure. So you start down the south of Italy, of Spain, and everyone's sitting there with one glass or glass of port or whatever it is, and they're just drinking it for the civilized pleasure of tasting good alcohol. Now, as you get further up north, further and further, further, people are drinking to forget. They're drinking not to celebrate, but to blot out, you know, these long winters. And by the time you're up in the Arctic Circle at the top of Norway, it's no coincidence that the fairly high alcoholism rates and sadly suicide rates as well, as you get lack the light and the sunshine and the joy, drinking becomes a single-minded thing to get drunk and not, you know, without sun, we drink to forget.
Yes, no, I agree. And I think one of the reasons why Britain has this outsized influence is because we are just in the right place. So we've got that love of intoxication and drunkenness, but it's not with the desperation of people further north.
Yeah.
And we have that access to the sunshine of the south, but with that intensity of
enjoyment that you get from living somewhere where the sun doesn't shine very often.
Yeah.
And I think what's sort of amazing about Port is that it's where it comes from. It's baking hot. There's no soil really to speak of.
So it's not fertile.
It's not fertile at all. You think of, you know, you think of a vineyard, you think of Burgundy, the sort of rolling hills and stuff. There's no soil. It's rock. It's schist. And they dynamited terraces where they grow the grapes. So it was just like a mountain. And to begin with, it was hacked out by hand, and then they dynamited it, which was, again, extremely dangerous, and built these terraces.
And they're beautiful, those terraces, aren't they?
Yeah. Which go down the hill. There's no soil. So the yields are incredibly low. It's something like a quarter of what you might get in Bordeaux.
Wow.
And the grapes are incredibly intense. So even with a very ordinary bottle of port, you know, like your Dow's Ruby or whatever it was, you're still getting incredible intensity of fruit. And if you find port a little bit too sweet, the Douro table wines still have that incredible intensity and that very, very low yield that comes from the hot climate, the very long growing season, and the terrible soil. I mean, Portugal is a sort of undiscovered gold mine for wine, really.
And is it, I often find with wine, even something as obvious as Albarino in Spain and Albarino in Portugal, and you often find pretty much within 4 miles of each other. You know, you've got the Rias Baixas and all that sort of side, and over the river you're into Portugal, but you're finding they're sometimes 10, 20 quid cheaper for almost exact wine, really, in terms of terroir. And just because it's Portuguese, you pay less for it somehow, and somehow there's something better inherently about Spanish wine, which is, well, it's not entirely true. But yeah, you know, you forget how close those two, some of those wine regions are. They're just split by a river, really, aren't they? So.
But I think it's the same as the, you know, you were talking about the Portuguese not being very good at selling themselves.
The Spanish love, you know, they're proud and conquistadors and all the rest of it, and the Portuguese don't. They're very modest. Even when there's a dictator in Portugal, he is overthrown by the Carnation Revolution. You know, everything in Portugal is much more modest, much less bravado, it's much more discreet, the whole thing. Although there is that deep vein of melancholy that runs through the country, doesn't it? Like Atlantic mist. Yeah.
So in this delicious glass of port, we have 650 years of Anglo-Portuguese relations. Tastes pretty good.
It's very good.
Well, that's the first episode of Intoxicating History, freshly decanted into podcast land. We really hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll come back for more next time when we're going super Christmassy, where we'll be looking at drinking in Charles Dickens, think Oliver Twist, Tale of Two Cities, and of course, Christmas Carol, which has so much eating and drinking in. If you'd like to find out more about this episode and our sponsors, Taylor's Port, we've got a website, intoxicatinghistory.com, where there's lots of information about all the books and drinks that we've mentioned. And we'd love to hear all your discussions, comments, queries, and ideas for future episodes on our Discord channel, which you can find on the website. And with that all said, Tom, please read us out.
Thanks, Henry. Intoxicating History is brought to you with the support of Taylor's Port. It was produced by Telltale Industries in association with TWS Creative and executive produced by Melanie Jappe and Jago Lee. Thanks for listening, and we cannot wait to be back with you with the next episode of Intoxicating History.
Honestly, port in your gravy is a game changer. If you like that episode, you can get loads more right now by searching for Intoxicating History wherever you're listening to this. But before you go, don't forget to follow Your Next Podcast right here so you don't miss out on all the great podcasts that I've got coming up for you. Plus, you can find all my recommendations along with news, reviews, and loads more on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. That's www.podcastrex.com.